We welcome Stéphanie Le Ménager. We already heard your voice, but we haven't introduced you properly. So Stéphanie Le Ménager is one of the founders of the US-American petroculture, critical petroculture studies, so to say. I think the term is somehow even yours, huh? Petroculture?
Actually, petromodernity is mine, but I would credit petroculture both to Amitav Ghosh and to Imre Zeman, who's a Canadian petrocritic,
But petromelancholia.
Petromelancholia, petromodernity.
Yeah, okay.
I have
so
many
we have petro noir, you have petromelancholia. So now, please, you will, again, we will have an opening, talk, and then we'll talk together.
Thank you so much. Just commenting a bit on the images that we saw from the film, my thought was what to do with such a leaking event as an oil spill. The spill, to me, functions as a kind of origin story of petromodernity, a kind of perpetually opening and reopening wound that, in fact, feeds oil culture by demanding our recommitment to it while showing us, nonetheless, its dysfunction and the fragility of its structures. Mario, in the film, is going to do something quite horrific after this ejaculatory scene of oil spill that you witnessed, and we'll see a little bit of the scene that I'm referring to later on. But as the oil lake deepens, he discovers he needs to make a choice. He has the choice of saving his friend, a man who some critics have described even as his lover, or he may take his friend's body as a handy sort of sandbag out of which to pull his truck from the oil lake. And he does the latter. He crushes his friend's leg. He brings about, ultimately, his friend's or his lover's death in the oil lake. And in an odd way, I think, given the logic of this film, Le Salaire de la Peur, this is the perhaps only heroic act that anyone in the film offers. Certainly not a moral act, but a heroic act in the sense of being a kind of superlative form of action that solidifies the men's shared commitment to oil's anti-humanist project, which is the only meaning-conferring context in the film. Let living oil in the USA begin with another spill, and you see an image of that here, one that is also a shower of money. Let it begin with James Dean, the American cinematic oil man of the 1956 film Giant, which we spoke a little bit about earlier. This is a humanist counterpart, I would say, to The Wages of Fear, as Le Salaire de la Peur is called in the United States. And by the way, this film was dubbed as an anti-American film in the 1950s and did not receive the kind of reception or even distribution that it apparently received in Europe. James Dean, caught in the ecstasy of oil, unmanned by it, claims the center of a sentimental genealogy where Texas, as it often does, stands in for all America, and where the oil baron, maybe he's James Dean or maybe he is J.R. Ewing, is somewhat like the devil, a devil you sort of find interesting and naughty, but the devil nonetheless. And yet, for all that, the petro sponsored every day of driving a car proves salvific, making possible unprecedented family intimacies that include in Giant interracial love and international reconciliation between Texans and their Mexican neighbors, many of whom live within Texas, which of course was once Mexican territory. Rock Hudson, one of the stars of the film, and his fledgling mixed Texan family drive the highways in and around what is now Marfa, capital of media and art, learning the meanings of pluralism in the midst of a barren chaparral. What oil offers in terms of ordinary life, freeways, cars, and unprecedented sorts of intimacy also serves the nostalgia of a petrohumanism that blinds itself, that must blind itself to the systemic functioning of carbon capital. We are in the early 20th century US, I would say, and even more so after the election of our current president, in the grip of a feeling state that I have called petromelancholia, And this is a melancholic attachment to fossil fuels and the version of American modernity and sort of exported modernity as well that they underwrite. The petroleum infrastructure has become embodied memory for modern Americans insofar as everyday events, such as driving our cars to the grocery store, which many of us do, or feeling the summer heat of asphalt, a petroleum product, on the soles of our feet, are repeated performances that become encoded in the body, decoupling our body's memory from the infrastructures that sustain it. May be one of the primary challenges to American ecological emotion and climate action into the 21st century. And two, the poignant and real North American grief for industrial jobs, for jobs in coal country or the Rust Belt or Northern Alberta has unfortunately not only produced real concern and protest, but also degraded across corporate and social media into a kind of libertarian meme that fossil fuel regulation consists of a sort of insult to personal freedoms, and in particular to white manhood. In the grip of petromelancholia, we forego what could be a productive kind of mourning, whether you think of productive mourning in this sense as following China into the renewables industry or maybe creating a low-carbon civil society. But we forego these productive forms of mourning, taking another object, in favor of contrarian symbolic performance. Now, the person who thinks himself, and I use that pronoun deliberately, the truest American, resists the decoupling of economic growth from ecological injury, which is a kind of cornerstone of sustainability. This patriot couples with fossil fuels. Consider rolling coal, which you're seeing an image of here, a symbolic performance which once was mainly deployed somewhat harmlessly at county fairs and car shows, that's now also a form of highway protest in the United States. Protest against the public space of assembly that is, or perhaps was, the street. Coal rolling makes for a kind of almost automobilic rape, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but I think there's a reason for saying that, perpetrated upon Prius drivers, anti-racist protests, immigrants, and even women. I sent Alexander and Benjamin a file of multiple coal rolling images, coal rollers just blasting women on the street with these big particulate clouds. I myself was driving in North Texas with my partner, and suddenly we were engulfed in a black cloud. And we didn't know, it was as if we'd gone into another dimension, sort of like sci-fi. And it was also as if we had been temporarily erased. Of course, you can imagine how attractive erasing two lesbians in a Prius would be for the person who was driving this particular truck. Let me tell you what coal rolling actually is, though, and how it works. Literally, rolling coal is the practice of modifying a diesel engine to increase the amount of fuel entering the engine in order to emit an under-aspirated, sooty exhaust that visibly pollutes the air. It also may include the intentional removal of the vehicle's particulate filter. Now, the cultural critic Stacy Alimo has given the name carbon-heavy masculinity to a complex of gendered expression from rolling coal to much more extreme and globally impactful events such as the US invasion of Iraq. From the petroleum-based styling products that maintain the iconic sweep of President Donald Trump's hair, to the new president's interest in drilling our national monuments, and his heartbreaking, to my mind, campaign lie that he would be able to rebuild coal industry jobs in Appalachia, one of the poorest regions of the US, carbon-heavy masculinity exploits and performs petromelancholia. And as a kind of top predator gender expression, it instigates other gendered performances lower on lower trophic levels, you might say. So for example, petroleum brides, petroleum marriages, in the salvific logics of everyday American oil culture, to be free is to resist the ecological imperative of decoupling. So ironically, you literally marry the oil field. In regions like West Texas's Permian Basin, where I surreptitiously took the next photograph. I wasn't really allowed to take the entire wedding party, but I saw the bride kind of huddling behind some old field machinery. Much cultural value resides in oil. The region calls itself after the seedbed of modern oil, the Permian Sea, and that sea is commemorated as the biodiverse origin of modernity in the world's largest petroleum museum in Midland, Texas. At the museum, local Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts retreat for campouts amongst defunct pump jacks. This is a regional culture where the memory of the Permian Sea offers itself as a substitute for ecologies lost to extraction and its manifestations in the built environment, manifestations like strip malls, suburbia, megachurches, and McMansions. The West Texas landscape is haunted by toxic iterations of that ancient ocean, the famous Wink sinks, which are giant sinkholes. This is a photograph I took recently, caused by subsidence related, though not entirely caused, by oil and gas extraction. The Wink sinks have become covert attractions, visited by teenagers on makeout dates, sites of fervent selfie taking, and even occasional wading in their toxic stew. One of the questions that I found myself asking a lot in the book that I wrote about oil culture in the U.S. called Living Oil was, how can the toxic labor of oil extraction be so amenable to love? And I want to just offer a tentative response and conclusion. My tentative response to this question is, first, let us consider skill. I think we've heard a lot about the intelligence and skill involved in oil production already on the stage today. Let skill stand for the world-making or co-creating that North American oil workers and even petrocritics do, as we're all, and I should say maybe not all, but many of us, certainly a petrocritic, living with and within oil. The world's matter co-creates us, we say, cleaving to a petro-humanism amenable to post-humanist analyses of fossil fuels as actants that assemble petro-subjectivities, socialities, and lives. In the era of climate change and the recognition of extractive externalities, for example, widespread controversy about fracking worldwide, petrohumanism has shifted its emphases from the pluralistic freedoms of the American road to an injured and truly poignant masculinity. The shale worker is the new anti-hero of petrohumanism, a pallid echo or remainder of the American century. This diminished oil man has been portrayed in Isaac Gale's short film, Crude Sweet Man Camp, a beautiful film about the Bakken Shale, wherein we see oil workers who have come there for good jobs sometimes, for temporary jobs, for truck driving jobs often, who do not find housing there right away. Some of them live in their trucks, they are alone, they are having a hard time finding a place to take a shower. And they become a kind of image of what happens when the manufacturing sector of a nation is more or less offshored. So think again of skill. It takes skill to operate a derrick, to work a frack well, to drive the ubiquitous trucks that carry prepared water in and out of shale zones. Skill is what the ordinary people of the Permian Basin and other oil-producing U.S. regions are proud of, what keeps them coming back to the orthodoxies of oil. The oil museums of Texas, and there are in fact several, prove the enduring power of the operational aesthetic, the pleasure associated with learning how something works. Neil Harris, an art historian, has said this is actually the only aesthetic that America ever really embraced or invented, because we were sort of too uneducated to be interested in anything else. Yet I asked myself a question again and again, walking these museums meant to archive not just oil's past, but the future that inevitably proceeds from it. And I saw again and again images of refineries, but no model humans, images of drill platforms, but very few model humans. Where are the people? One text box in the museum asked. And that was my question, because the material intimacies of skill have been eclipsed in so many cases by automation. Automation, of course, haunts so many industries now, not less among them the industries of fossil fuel extraction and refinement. Oil work is financial in many respects nowadays. Where are the people? As a genre of humanism, petrohumanism hides in plain sight of its demise, keening for what perhaps never was, the oil man set apart from systemic overreach, the oil man as maker of his world. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We already spent a lot of time, so we have to a little bit rush through things. But I want to, can we see the image with Mario in the refinery? Image number one. I want to just shortly ask, actually I wanted to skip it, but now that you, with your question with other people, you know, there's, is it there? Yeah. When preparing for this, we made this kind of diagram where, you know, we filled in some of the scenes of the and the characters of the film into a diagram of a refinery. Mm. And so and the question actually that is behind that is in the description of the film, it is titled A Modern Tragedy, but we asked ourselves if actually under these circumstances tragedy is still possible. And that, you know, so, you know, that film also is full of this carbon-heavy masculinity that you describe, but obviously it's completely somehow, you know, without any benefit for them, you know, for this, for those carbon-heavy masculines, because you know they are just like actually machine parts serving, as it says, the purpose of the petroleum. So the question is whether this, to see it like that already in the late 1940s, early 1950s, which we call petro-noir, and this your genre of petro-melancholia, which you call a humanist genre, how this comes together, whether it's actually the same, and maybe how it refers to this question of tragedy and the social, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I think tragedy, you know, implies, to me, it implies humanism. And it implies, first of all, the cathartic experience of the viewer, the feelings of pity and fear, and what we might call in a more contemporary parlance, empathy. It also implies not a corrupt character per se, but a character with some sort of hamartia, weakness, bad judgment, who sort of by accident finds himself, typically male, to have fall from a very high place. And so when I think of that story of tragedy, I don't think of the very bleak, noir framing of Le Salaire de la Peur. This is an anti-humanist portrait of oil, which is actually too realistic for the genre of tragedy. But what I do think of is what I think is going on now in the U.S. as we kind of reckon with energy transition that is not happening. I don't believe that fossil fuels, by the way, can simply be dismissed as an energy source, but to really think seriously about the effects of the industry on climate, to really think seriously, too, about the fact that the jobs that are promised with the new shale so-called revolution have not, for the most part, fed local economies which are suffering. You know, the tragedy I see is actually of petromodernity itself, of a kind of overreaching, in some ways well-meaning futurism of the past, which has come to its dregs, come to a kind of end state that it cannot acknowledge. Petrohumanism keeps alive the worlds that oil has made and extends in some ways the oil resources, which are, if not dwindling per se, becoming more and more and more and more difficult to get out of the ground and creating more volatile boom-bust kinds of economies in shale regions. So that tragedy to me is structural. It's a tragedy of a cultural complex. The cultural complex is the actor. I think petro-noir saw that. I think the film sees that very, very early on and never holds the sort of humanist dream of a kind of prosthetic extension of one's powers, even one's ethical abilities through petrochemicals, through petroleum products, through the automobile even, that has been a very big part of American dreaming.
I'm trying to find the link to the Russian story that we are going to hear now, and I think it is still in this question of the position of the human being, actually. So some of the theories that Oksana also pointed to and the things that she told us are actually turning around the thing completely, you know, the question who's ruling whom, and kind of, you know, saying, okay, we look at it in a perspective that far exceeds the perspective of the human, and say that the agency actually is with this substance that is far older than we are, and you know, in a way, will maybe outlasts us and just uses, so to say, humans to free its potentials. I don't know if this perspective really makes sense. Probably not for us, but. I think that the rather extremist view that Alexander Ilyichevsky takes in some of his thoughts he has in the text that we are now going to have read out to us in Russian with titles in English and German, and that refers in parts to a text that was written by a Russian author in the 1930s. Yes, in the 1932, I think. Paustovsky is his name, has this kind of theory about the parallel emergence of life as such and oil that is, you know, is exceeding this human perspective and trying to be somehow maybe anti-humanistic. So let's listen to this now, please.